If you have a Bible, we're going to be in Genesis. We're going to start in Genesis 4 this morning. If I haven't met you yet, my name is Tim, and I'm really glad you're here. How y'all doing? Good. All right. I'm excited. We got some things to talk about today. We are in week 3 of our series on community, and for me, this has been I was able to sit under Chad's teaching last week, and it's just been a powerful series to work through and to think through. As you're aware, loneliness is now being considered an epidemic in our culture, in our Western culture. It's not just America, but it's for sure true here. Loneliness is an epidemic. And so we've been talking about what does it mean to be community, and how can the Christian church be a community that is a countercultural example that is actually waging war on loneliness? Can we change that in our culture? Can we do something about it? I don't have to convince you that loneliness is a big deal or a painful deal. Many of you experience loneliness. But if I did have to convince you, I might try it like this. I don't know if you were aware. How many of you this past Wednesday heard what happened with the British Prime Minister, Theresa May? Oh, I get to tell you. All right. Yeah, a couple of you. This is interesting. So on Wednesday, the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, looked at some of the stats and the figures. I'm sure that's been going on for a while. But she made the decision that there should be a government position in place that is specifically set aside to deal with loneliness. Some are referring to it as the Minister for Loneliness. I'm not making this up. My first instinct was, well, that's a very British thing to do, create a whole government job on it. But actually, when you look at the stats, the New York Times reported some really interesting statistics on loneliness that I'll present them to you. One of the things they reported was that loneliness is worse for health than smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Isn't that interesting? So before you go tell your friend, quit smoking, they may not be your friend anymore, and that's going to hurt you more than they're smoking. okay, get this. A gentleman by the name of Dr. Vivek Murthy. Vivek. Male? Female? I'm sorry. I don't know. Former U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Vivek Murthy, in the Harvard Business Review, reported that loneliness has a greater risk than it poses for us as a culture, a greater risk than cardiovascular disease, dementia, depression, and anxiety. Let me say that again. Loneliness presents a greater risk than cardiovascular disease, dementia, depression, and anxiety. Now, again, I don't have to convince you that loneliness is not good. This has been clear since day one. One of the first things you read in the Bible, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. One of the first it is not goods in the Bible, the first it is not good, is around loneliness. God, before the fall, before sin ever enters into the world, God says it's not good that people are alone. That is not good. We have been wired to be connected to each other. We've been wired for community. We've been created for community. That's the series title. We've been created for community. And one of the things we've been talking about and kind of using to frame our conversation are the four questions that we all ask when it comes to community. Like, is this a place that can be my community? The four questions are these. Number one, do I belong here? A couple weeks ago, we talked about whether or not the church, if we're trying to be this countercultural community, whether or not people feel like they can belong here. What does that mean for us? How do we deal with that? Second question is, do you see me? Do you see me? Do you see me as I really am? If I were to take off the mask and I was just to kind of like be myself with my sense of humor, my personality, do you see me? And would I still belong if I was truly me? So Pastor Chad led us through that last week. Next week, we're going to talk about, am I safe here? Will the church protect me? Will the community protect me? Or if I were to step out of line, or will I be the first to get a stone thrown at me? I mean, this is a question we ask, right? We'll deal with that next week. But this week, I want to talk about, and this is a fun one, what if we disagree? Can I stay here even if we disagree? Even if we don't see eye to eye on this? Even if I think it's this way and you think it's that way, can we still be in community together? Or if we disagree, do we have to go our separate ways? Now, we've been kind of framing the series through the first couple chapters of Genesis. To be honest with you, when it comes to that question, what if we disagree? The first couple chapters of Genesis how do you say this? They're less than inspiring. They're less than inspiring. So we spent the last couple weeks in Genesis 1, 2, and 3 looking at this couple, Adam and Eve, and their relationship with God and with each other and with the soil, with the earth. Chapter 4, where we'll be in today, chapter 4 introduces a different couple, not a romantic couple, but a couple of brothers, guys by the name of Cain and Abel. And I'll give you the spoiler alert. One of them kills the other one. So the disagreement ends in death. Let me read you the story. See how this plays out. Verse 1, Adam made love to his wife Eve, and she became pregnant and gave birth to Cain. She said, "With the help of the Lord, I have brought forth a man." Later, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now, Abel kept flocks, and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. Let me just pause there real quick. Notice God doesn't ask for the offering. I had a whole long section that had a cut for time, but God doesn't ask for the offering. The prophets later in the scriptures will have a ton of commentary on this. The sacrificial system was really our idea, and God kind of put some parameters on our own idea, actually, and says, okay, you can't kill humans. You can't. There's certain things you can't do, but if you need to know that you stand in good standing with me, okay, I'll accept it. So Cain brings an offering to the Lord, verse 4. Abel also brought an offering, fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. So the offerings are different. I don't have time to talk about this in detail, but it seems as though Cain is just bringing some to try to get God off his back. That's in his head. But Abel is actually saying, you know what? I am going to trust God. I'm going to bring the first, the fat portions, the yummy stuff. I'm going to bring that to God. And so the offerings are a bit different. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering, he did not look with favor. I don't have a really clear answer for that other than he brings his first fruits and it seems as though Cain just kind of brings whatever's left, but maybe God prefers steak to veggies. I don't know. But he doesn't like Cain's offering. So Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted?" So you were accepted the whole time. You didn't have to give me the offering. I accepted you the whole time. And if you keep doing what's right, will you not be accepted? Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must rule over it. I find this to be a powerful image. Sin is crouching at your door. Essentially, God says, Cain, sin right now is like a dog ready to pounce, but you don't have to let it win. You can control, you have control over this. The dog, the sin does not have to get the last word. You can take it down. You can win. Now Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out to the field." While they were in the field, Cain attacked his brother Abel and killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Where's your brother Abel?" Which, by the way, a very similar question that God asked after Adam and Eve sinned. Because we hide when we sin. "Where's your brother Abel?" "I don't know," he replied. Which is, really? But yeah, you notice how many times it says, "Your brother Abel? Where's your brother Abel? What about your brother Abel?" There's like three or four times in just a couple of verses. Brother Abel, brother Abel. Which sets up this next question that Cain has for God. He says, "Am I my brother's keeper?" The Lord said, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. Am I my brother's keeper?" Are you? Are we? Maybe some of you are thinking like, oh, the Bible, like that's this old book. It's a bit archaic. I know these are some of the things that are said about Christians. We just studied this old book. But is this not the question we still wrestle with? Is there any more relevant question? We still wrestle with chapter 4 of the Bible, like trying to figure out this question. Are we our brother's keeper? Is it our responsibility if you're poor? Is it my responsibility if you're poor? Do I have to help you if you're poor? Or is that your responsibility? You got yourself in the mess. Do we not ask this question? If your country's war-torn and you're a refugee, is that our responsibility? Or is that your country's responsibility? Am I my brother's keeper? Is it survival of the fittest, survival of the smartest, survival of those who are born in the right air, right with the right zip code? Or do we have a responsibility to care for one another? This is the question at the heart of Genesis 4. And God's response seems to be, yeah, yeah. He says, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood cries out from the ground. And by the way, isn't that the story of like history in a blip as well? So let's imagine an alien comes down and says, oh, can you explain your people? We could explain human history like this. We invented some stuff. We disagreed on some things. And then we used that invention to kill them. Right? Is that not? And then times a billion. Because it plays out over and over and over and over again. And God says, I hear the blood. It cries out from the ground. How much blood and how loud are those cries in the ears of our God? This is Genesis chapter 4. Now, that brings us to Jesus. Because Jesus, God incarnate, God in the flesh, sets out to show humanity another way to live. There was Cain's way. We disagree, we kill you. But Jesus sets out to create a countercultural example. He calls it his church. We're going to embody another way of living in the world. Not Cain's way, but a whole radically different system. Jesus sets out to create a new movement. Now, the early church embraced this. The early church took this really seriously. In fact, historians will argue that that the early church was the first community. Paul, in Galatians, was the first person ever to argue for equality between men and women. That's a Christian contribution to the discussion. The early Christian church certainly had their disagreements. I mean, if you read the book of 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, like those two books, like there's disagreements all over the place, right? There's disagreements everywhere in 1 and 2 Corinthians. Because this new movement was the first movement in human history that we know of that would say, poor and wealthy, you're at the table. Come to the table. Slave and free, come to the table. Gentile and Jew, come to the table. Male and female, come to the table. But what if we disagree on some things? What if we don't see eye to eye on some things? Well, come to the table. The early Christian church understood that what held us together is far greater than what separates us. You follow? So now the question, where did they get this idea? Well, Jesus. Which raises the second question of how do they do this in a way that doesn't divide the church? How does the early church, because for the first 300 years, they somehow stay united, even though they're bringing all these different factions of people together. How do they do it without getting divided? According to the World Christian Encyclopedia right now, in our nation, there are, get this, 33,000 different denominations of Christianity. We're not very good at this. So how did they do that? Did you know that the CRC, the Christian Reformed Church, and the Reformed Church in America divided over a debate about the Elks Lodge? We're not very good at this. Small things and petty things have divided us. So how is it that the early Christian church was able to stay together? And what we observe from history is that they had a model. They had an understanding of what it means to be in community together. And they steal the model directly from Jesus. Directly from Jesus. So if you have a Bible, let me show you the model. This, for me, shouldn't have been an aha, but it was an aha. If you have a Bible, the book of Mark, Gospel of Mark. We'll just be in chapter 1. Let's go about this way. So sometimes when we study, we will fly really low and we'll look at like a word and talk about the history of that word and the context and the culture of that word and go really, really deep. Other times I find it's more helpful to fly a bit higher and to look at flow, to look at what comes before it, what comes after it. This is one of those examples. What I want you to catch in just one chapter of the Bible, I want you to get a rhythm of Jesus' relationships. So I want you to catch the rhythm of how Jesus orients his life, how he engages in community with other people. And so we're going to fly a bit high and just look at a typical day or week or month in the life of Jesus. Again, this was an aha for me. So Mark chapter 1 begins with a story of Jesus' baptism. And we are told that Jesus comes from somewhere alone and enters into a crowd where his cousin John the Baptist baptizes him. And we read this, verse 5. The whole Judean countryside and all the people of Jerusalem went out to John the Baptist. So the first story of Jesus, according to Mark, is a story of Jesus entering into a crowd. A lot of people. Then we read this, verse 12. At once the Spirit sent him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness for 40 days being tempted by Satan. So the first story is Jesus in a crowd. The second story is Jesus all alone. Then we read this. Jesus comes out of the wilderness and he calls some friends, disciples. Later he'll call these disciples his friends. And we read this, verse 16. As Jesus walked beside the Sea of Galilee, so he's alone, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come follow me, Jesus said, and I will send you out to fish for people. At once they left their nets and they followed him. So he's in a crowd, then he's alone, then he's with friends. Then he goes back into the crowds. He teaches in the synagogue. People love it. And then we read this, verse 28. News about him spread quickly over the whole region of Galilee. And so he's back in crowds again. Then the next story, he goes and he spends some time with a few close friends and he actually goes into one of their homes. And it's almost as though they're family. Because your family doesn't have to be blood, right? Like, you can have people that are so close to you, they pour into you. It's as though these friends are actually family. Verse 29, as soon as they left the synagogue, they went with James and John to the home of Simon and Andrew. Simon's mother-in-law was in bed with a fever, and they immediately told Jesus about her. So he went to her immediately, took her hand, and helped her up. Then, the next story, so you get the rhythm. Crowds, alone, friends, with family, with crowds. The next story. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Alone. Then the next story, his friends come to find him because he's all on his own and there's still work to be done. And so they say, Jesus, everyone is looking for you. To which Jesus replies, let's go somewhere else. Which I find awesome. I love that Jesus has a little bit of a antisocial side to him, because I have that too. But actually, the reason is because Jesus has a very clear sense of mission, and he has to keep moving. He's very centered on what he's got to do in the world. And he says, let's go somewhere else to the nearby villages so I can preach there also. That's why I've come. So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. So he goes from being alone back into a crowd. And then we read, there's a phrase that comes up a lot when he's near a crowd. This phrase, verse 43. Anybody else hear that whiz? Okay. Anything I can do about that? We had the same thing last service, and our Paws with a Cause dog is not here, but that would drive them nuts. Right? Can you imagine, like, stop it. All right, verse 43. This is a warning Jesus gives often when he's in front of a crowd. He says, Jesus sent him away, so he heals somebody. Sent him away at once with a strong warning. See that you don't tell this to anyone. Don't tell anyone about me. Now, why would he say that? Because crowds will turn on you pretty quickly. But do you catch the rhythm of Jesus' relationships? Do you catch it? He's in a crowd, then he's alone, then he's with friends, and he's with friends that are so close that they're like family. Then he's alone, then he's in a crowd, then he's with friends, and he's with alone, and he's in a crowd, and then he's with friends. Basically, what I'm trying to say is Jesus' life at some level was a whole lot like yours, right? With the maybe exception of he probably didn't Netflix binge every once in a while. But everything else, like, he's in crowds, you're in crowds, and then you go and you're hanging out with friends, and then you got family, and then you're alone, and you're in crowds, and you're with friends, and you're with family, and then you're alone. But maybe the one exception, at least this may be true for my life, is Jesus is really intentional about those different spheres. Really intentional about it. This was the aha for me. This kind of sparked an insight that sparked an insight that sparked an insight. Here's the aha. Jesus, if you read the stories closely, we flew over top of them, but if you read them closely, Jesus acts differently in different spaces. Now, he's not different, always has integrity, but Jesus responds to different groups of people differently. Now, I don't know why this was an aha. It shouldn't be. Like, that's how we've been wired this way, right? If I trust you, I'm going to open up differently to you than if I don't know you. So I would expect that would be true of Jesus. But I guess I always grew up just thinking that, oh, Jesus just kind of walked around, taught, and teached, and everything was equal. But no, what you discover is when you dive close is Jesus engaged the different kinds of people differently. And the early church caught this. You can almost think of Jesus' life as like concentric circles. I love that language Chad gave us last week, concentric circles. like, let's just study the circles. I'm going to show you the circles. So the first one we have are, let's start at the outside, the crowds. The crowds. We read that Jesus encounters a lot of crowds. He's pretty brilliant, and he heals people. Raising a man from the dead has a way of drawing a crowd. Would you agree? So Jesus had crowds of people that followed him everywhere. Now, what's interesting is when you pay attention to Jesus in the crowds, Jesus tends to keep the crowds at a bit of a distance. In fact, anytime the crowds get too large and are pushing in too much, Jesus has a way of saying things to kind of thin out the crowd. Like, Jesus is probably the one person that's ever walked this planet that didn't want to be famous. He'll say things that's like, okay, how do I know who's really on board here? So, for instance, someday look up John chapter 6. We read in John 6 that the crowds are pressing up against Jesus. And so Jesus says to the crowds, if you're serious about following me, eat my flesh and drink my blood. And they all kind of go. It's like that moment where Kanye walks on the stage and says, sorry, Taylor. Right? Like, he's here, and then all of a sudden everyone's like, whoa, no, because crowds will turn on you. That's the lesson of history. Jesus understands crowds will turn on you in an instant. And so Jesus kind of keeps the crowds at a distance. Now, the next circle are his disciples. Jesus lets his disciples in much closer. To the crowds, Jesus says, I speak in parables, but I will explain the parables to the disciples, whom he calls his friends. Now, even amongst his friends, his disciples, there are different circles. So there are the 120, then there are the 72, and then there are the 12. Now, there are things that Jesus will tell the 72 that he doesn't tell the 120. There are things that Jesus will talk about with the 12 that he doesn't talk about with the 72. But this is the sphere where Jesus is really open to disagreement. In fact, the disciples disagree on a lot of things. We'll go there in a moment. But the next level is the three. Jesus has three disciples who are so close that they almost function like family. Three guys by the name of Peter, James, and John. Now, to these three guys, Jesus brings really close. In fact, I don't know that there's, other than Jesus sneaking off alone, every other story, these guys are involved in it. These guys are the ones that, okay, let's leave the 12 and let's go up a mountain for an event that we know as the Transfiguration. Jesus lets the three in to see who he is in full. Jesus has a deep kind of family-like relationship with the three. And then lastly, so there are the crowds, there are the friends, then there are like the different kinds of friends, then there are the friends that are so close that they're like family. And finally, Jesus spends a lot of time alone with God. Jesus spends a lot of time alone with God. He has a really personal, intimate connection with his Father. Some of the most intimate moments are just him and his Father. Jesus is fully open and fully vulnerable when he's alone with God. So for instance, we have this moment, the Garden of Gethsemane. He's about to be killed. And Jesus says to his 12 disciples, okay, stay here and wait. And he sneaks off to be with his Father. And he says, Dad, it's like, Dad, I don't, is there any other way? Now, I think he knows the answer to that question. I believe he knows the answer to that question. And yet, when you are truly intimate, you ask the question. There's no fear in asking the question. And so he says, does it have to be this way? Or can there be another way? If you could, would you let the cup pass? I don't want to have to drink the cup of judgment, as he refers to it. So real intimacy in the center circle. Does this make sense? I know it's terribly interesting, but here's the relevance. For me, it's so simple, but it has been so helpful to me to think about the different spheres. So let's talk about you in your life and me in my life and how this actually plays out at a functional level, especially as we think about loneliness, the epidemic across our country. How does this play out? Again, let's start with the crowds. Let me say it this way. If you're lonely, the crowds are probably not going to be of much help to you. Can we see that in the life of Jesus? If you're lonely, the crowds are probably not much help to you. Because the thing with the crowds are, they turn on you in an instant. Crowds will turn on you in an instant. This is why famous people are often so lonely. Because they don't know who's my crowds and who's my family and who's my friends. Who's just using me and who actually wants to love me and know me. Because crowds turn on you in an instant. you say one thing that's a bit like off, and the people who are following you all of a sudden turn on you. You do one thing that is a little bit taboo or whatever, and the crowds will immediately turn on you. You deflate one football. Unfortunately, for women, celebrities, for ladies, it's you get one wrinkle and your fan base all of a sudden shifts. Sad. But crowd, that's the nature of the crowds. There's nothing that connects them other than they decide to follow you for a while. I was reading this week, so if you're familiar with Justin Timberlake. Yeah. So Justin Timberlake, playing the Super Bowl, got an album coming out this week. He came out with a teaser video for his album. Okay, he's probably, arguably, after the Trolls song, one of the most famous celebrities in our culture. Would you agree with that? He came out with a teaser video. And his fan base, really interesting to read, his fan base turns on him. Many of them, not all of them. But many of his fan base all of a sudden are saying things like, sell out. He hasn't even released the album yet. And that's because that's the nature of a crowd. This is also true in Christian circles, unfortunately. Christian crowds can be like this. If you don't believe me, Google the name Jen Hatmaker. How quickly somebody can be, we really enjoy your books, we really appreciate you, too. We hate you. Because that's the nature of a crowd. So if you're lonely, I would suggest being careful of the crowds and expecting that the crowds are going to fulfill your loneliness. We see this best exemplified in the life of Jesus. So Jesus marches into Jerusalem on an event we know as Palm Sunday. And what do the crowds shout? Hosanna! Hosanna! You're our king, Jesus! And a few days later, the crowds gather up again, and what are they shouting? Kill him! Why? He's not the king they wanted. They thought he was going to go, like, hurt Rome, but he didn't do that. He's not fighting back, and so all of a sudden they turn on him. That's the nature of a crowd. Let's bring it a little closer to home, because I think we all know that fame and celebrity, like, it's probably not the solution, even though we all kind of want it. It's probably not the solution. Social media is, unless you're really disciplined in your social media, like you only use social media for your friends and your family, your closest friends and your closest family, it's a bit of a crowd. Can we name that? If you have 1,000 friends on Facebook or Instagram, 1,000 people, and they may all be fantastic. They probably are all great people. And yet, they are a bit of a crowd. And so you post one thing and all of a sudden, a political thing that they disagree with. And you're all of a sudden, you have division and disagreement. And we can't handle disagreement in crowds. If it is not wise, this is my opinion. It is not wise, I don't believe. It is not wise to expect the crowds to understand how to deal with our personal pain and loneliness. To post, I'm so sad and I'm so lonely. What often happens is people may like it. People may send a heart emoji. But that heart, unless they're willing to get in their car and actually hang out with you, you posting I'm lonely and them saying like or heart emoji doesn't actually help you in your loneliness. If anything, it just makes you think, I just shared this with the world and now no one's responding. Be careful of the crowds. That's the rhythm we see in Jesus' life. Be careful with the crowds. Now, the next level, the disciples. So there are the crowds, then there are the disciples. Now, the thing with the disciples is they disagree on almost everything, literally. The group Jesus gathers, even in the 12, so the 120, the 72, and the 12. The 12 are all over the map on like political issues, all over the place. You have a guy by the name of the ragtag group Jesus assembles. You have a guy by the name of Simon the Zealot. Zealots were a militant rebel branch, many of whom would carry a hooked dagger in their cloak so that they could stab a Roman soldier should they stumble upon a Roman soldier. They hated the Romans. So Jesus calls Simon the Zealot and he calls Matthew the tax collector who works for Rome. He's like, hey, both of you, come follow me. Like that's the tag, the ragtag group. They disagree completely. Jesus calls politically left and politically right people into the same family. You're going to be my friends. You're going to be my disciples. Jesus calls people who are all over the place. He calls pacifists and so like Essenes, pacifists, and Jesus will call like zealots. Violence is a solution. The disciples disagree on almost everything, but what they understand is the things that hold them together are bigger. Namely, Jesus is bigger than the things that can divide us. Then you get the three. Now, the three, some moments, they're let in on those really special, intimate moments. Peter, James, and John. The thing with the three is they disagree on a lot of things too. In fact, there is this weird rivalry in your Bible. We talked about it a couple years ago. But Peter and John have this weird rivalry. Jesus is resurrected, and they are arguing about who's faster. It's just really petty and bizarre. And Jesus is about to ascend, you know, like float away. And I don't think he did this. That would have been probably steals from the drama. But Jesus is about to ascend to heaven, and you have them like arguing about who's going to die first. They disagree on a lot of things. And yet, when it comes down to the end, when it comes down to the mission, they have to go into the world. Guess who are always at the tip of the spear? United. John and Peter. Because that's family, isn't it? Your family, you guys could disagree. You can go at it like good family, loving family. It doesn't have to be blood family, but your friends who are so close, you can totally disagree with them. And yet at the end of the day, something happens in your family. A kid gets sick. A tragedy strikes, and they're there. The crowds aren't there. Sometimes the disciples are there, but your family is there. I would say we all need really good family. We all need really good family. And sometimes you don't get, like, that family doesn't choose you. You've got to go looking for it. One of the things, the best things I've heard on, like, your friends is that the two most important things in life are the choices you make and the people you choose. Isn't that true? Like, the friends you choose to hang out with matter. Choose your three really, really carefully. And I know that goes without saying, parents, you take this really seriously because you want to make sure you know that your kids' friends will influence your kids. We need family. We need family. We need family. And in order to have really good friends, by the way, it requires us to be good friends. Like, that's one of the things we can learn in church. To have good friends requires us to be good friends, which means you actually have to say no to the crowds and to the disciples so that you can say yes to the good friends. How many of you found yourself in that predicament? You got a lot of friends. But you actually have to say no to some of the acquaintance type friends, because if you want this friendship to go deep, you have to be present for them. How many of you feel like I'm trying to spin all these plates and I can't keep all of these different crowds of people happy? And at some point you just have to realize, or you've realized, I just have to let some of those plates drop so that I can say yes to this family. You know what I mean? There's a three. And then there is the relationship with God. Jesus often retreats, especially after he deals with the crowds. He'll retreat to be alone with God. This is something I encountered in my life. I had this realization early in my ministry that I was running and thinking, I don't need a full Sabbath. As though I could do ministry better than Jesus. Because Jesus did. Jesus needed alone time with God. And how arrogant. Then I got to the point where I'm like, well, I don't need a full day to just like rest and reconnect with God. I just need a couple hours. What you discover with Jesus is in order for Jesus, like, your life will drain your battery. And in order for Jesus to do the ministry, to do the work he's called to do, he needs that intimate moment with God for God to recharge the battery. So, after saying all that, after looking at the concentric circles, what are we on Sunday morning? When we gather on a Sunday morning, of those, which are we? Well, I'll say this. I hope that we have times when we gather that we have moments when we're alone with God the Father. You can be with other people and still find God, right? I think this is why a lot of you shut your eyes when you sing. You want to hear the voice of God, right? So we can get some of that. I'll tell you this. I sincerely hope we're not the crowds. I think it's a temptation we can fall for. I think in Christian circles even we can fall for it of, we're here until we disagree with you, and then we're out, right? When we like the preacher, when we like the band songs, when we like the kids ministry, when we like the coffee, we're in. But as soon as those things turn, we're out. That's a crowd, right? Crowds will turn in an instant. I don't think we're the crowds, would you? I mean, not South Harbor. We're not the crowds. Let me also say this. I don't think we're the three. I don't know that we're family. I had this, so growing up, I would, in church settings, typically a pastor, and always well-intentioned, good people, but would stand on a stage and say, you know, we're just one big family. The problem is, I didn't even know everyone's name. So we got to at least be honest. It's hard in a room this large to truly be family, to have this many family members and be family to each other is really hard. Now, we shouldn't inhibit that. But I think we should probably at least be honest on a Sunday morning. If you're lonely this morning and think that just showing up to a 75-minute worship service that's predominantly Tim talking on a stage is going to answer the loneliness that you feel at the deepest ache of your soul, you're probably going to be really, really significantly let down. We need family. Which is why we keep saying, like, hey, we have these Kairos groups, we have this. We can create, what we can do is leverage our time together to try to help each other connect, because I know some of us are introverted and some of us are, it's just really hard to do that. And so we can help, like, connect each other to each other. But unfortunately, I can't make friends for you. Sounds weird to say. Okay, let me tell this story. I was at the gym a couple of days ago, and that was a couple weeks ago now. I was talking to this guy, and this guy was telling me in his church that he has tried to go to all the small groups, all of them. I'm like, really, all of them? All of them. I went to all of them, and I tried all the programs, and no one's friendly. I'm just listening to this guy. He's like, no one's friendly. No one at my church is friendly. So at least I appreciate he's not a crowd, because he still goes. But he's like, no one's friendly. I've gone to all the small groups. Part of me is like, well, really? Because, people tend to go out of their way in church settings to be extra nice. Can't imagine you found the one church with all jerks. But maybe. But what I want, I didn't say this because I don't know him. I'm not in a relationship with him. But I didn't say this. I just said, but in my head, what I wanted to say was, do you know how to be a friend? You know, maybe the reason they're not friendly is because you have no idea how to be a friend. That's a tough pill to swallow. But like, to be a friend requires you to like contribute back, and to be a friend, like, that's something that we can all work on. So what we try to do when we gather is we probably can't be family. What we can do is teach each other how to be friends. We can connect each other with each other and try to, and out of that, we've seen families bond. We've seen new families kind of emerge in these walls. So we want to provide opportunities for those who are introverted and shy. But here's my question then. So if we're not we can maybe get out alone time with God. We probably, on a Sunday morning at least, if this is our only connection point, maybe in the back afterwards, but we probably can't develop family. So which are we? I heard it over here. I would say that we're the disciples. We have to be. I actually think there's no other option. We have to be the disciples. Now here's the power of the disciples. Something powerful happens when a group of Jesus followers who share the same mission band together. There are things that we can do that the crowds will never do because they're not united. And there are things that we can do together that the family never can do because there's not enough of them. See, the power of a Sunday morning, the power of the Sunday gathering is we get to worship God together, but then we get to be strategic and we get to look at the problems of our world. And right now I'm talking about loneliness. We can say we can do something about this. Let me share a story. Actually, let me give this real quick. If you want more information, I don't have enough time. But a book to read is a book called The Vanishing Neighbor. Really interesting. Essentially, the author of this book argues that it's a good read. The author of the book argues that the neighborhood, your neighbors, your relationship with your neighbors is going away. He talks about it's like hardening, like we're not actually connecting with our neighbors. Pastor Chad talked a lot about this last week. But essentially what he's saying is if disciples are friends, the friend zone is shrinking. I was quite familiar with the friend zone in high school, so that feels like comfortable language. What's good about that in some ways is what we have, we can choose a couple of friends and we can go really deep. But what's hard about that is when something like the neighbor that could come over and check up on you periodically, we don't actually have a relationship with that neighbor anymore. So it's like we actually need those kind. The church can reclaim that. The second book that you should read is a book called Bowling Alone. This one's a little bit boring, but it's unless you're the author listening to the podcast, which would never happen. But it's fascinating if you like statistics and if you like the concrete data. What the argument of the book is, back in the day, so if you're over 50, you may remember this, there were things like bowling leagues. And you would go to these bowling leagues and you would have community. You weren't really family together, but you knew each other. You checked in on each other. If something happened, you would pool your resources. You would pull out your wallet and give some money. But now people are bowling alone. Those community clubs don't happen. We've outsourced them to social media, the argument is. Third book, this one I highly recommend. Jonathan Sacks, a book called The Dignity of Difference. Fascinating book. One point that's relevant for the day. He talks about how back in the day, and this isn't that long ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we would come home from work and we would watch one of three news channels, 3, 8, or 13, right? 3, 8, or 13. So we would receive the news, and then all of us the same news, and then if we disagreed on the news, we would talk about it. But we'd all receive the same news. So it was called broadcasting, because we're broadcasting one thing. He says we've left that, and now we narrowcast. We choose the news we want to watch that fits our political opinions. The danger, he argues, is that in doing that, not only have we narrowcasted the news, but we've narrowcasted our friends. So if I want friends that all like the Detroit Lions, I find a club on Facebook and we talk, right? Which I'm part of. we don't talk much these days. If you want a community, so he talks a lot about like we will find peers. So if I'm a pastor, I'll get in a pastor network with other pastors, which is great. Here's where the problem is, as he points out. In doing that, we have these friends, but they're scattered. So when something happens, the neighbor who could check in on you, well, they're like that guy on Facebook doesn't care. He's living in Detroit. Does this make sense? The church can reclaim this. So in a world that continues to divide and divide and divide, we can bring neighbors together who may be divided on political issues. But under Jesus, as disciples, we can become friends. Loneliness is real. Let me read you a story. We'll end here. Let me set it up. How many of you are familiar with the comedian Sarah Silverman? Show of hands. Okay. How many of you are familiar with a conversation she had on Twitter a couple weeks ago? Anyone? Oh, okay. I'm going to show you there's Sarah Silverman. I don't know if I would recommend just going and finding, as your pastor, I don't know. I haven't heard much of her comedy. I'm sure it's funny though, but this post, this Twitter exchange between this guy and her absolutely blew me away when I first encountered it. Absolutely blew me away. A buddy of mine, who goes here, his name's Scott, sent me the link and I was just so moved by this exchange. Essentially, it's somebody who's really lonely, reaches out to her, but the way he reaches out is by trolling her. You familiar with trolling language? It's like internet language for when you just purposefully are mean to somebody just to get a response. So he's purposefully mean. He actually calls her awful, offensive word just to kind of get a reaction from her, expecting she's going to come back with an awful, you know, like she's Sarah Silverman, she's going to come back at him. But she doesn't respond how he thinks. So let me read you the exchange. I think I got all the swears. I'll show you the exchange. I'm going to read it up there. This is the exchange over Twitter. I believe in you. So this guy writes this really nasty word. He says, I believe in you. I read your timeline and I see what you're doing and your rage is thinly veiled pain. But you know that. I know this feeling. And he had mentioned his back. I forgot to say that. P.S. My back hurts too. See what happens when you choose love. I see it in you. He responds, I can't choose love. For the sake of young ears. He was violated as a child. And he says, the man messed me up and I'm poor, so it's hard to get help. She responds, can't imagine your rage. Just reading that makes me want to do bad things. Stand by. And she says, questions, not judging. Are you doing heroin? Are you self-medicating? Do you want to get clean? She's trying to get at the root of, okay, you're hurting. This thing happened to you. Are you self-medicating? He says, no, I just smoke weed. prescribe medications, which I take accordingly. She responds, good, I want to kill him too, so I can't imagine your rage. All I know is this rage, and even if you could kill him, it's punishing yourself, and you don't deserve punishment. You deserve support. Go to one of these support groups. You might meet your best bros there. He responds. Now remember, this guy just said an awful word about her, and then this exchange, simply because she decided to ask some questions, this kind of plays out. He says, I will go, but I trust no one. I've been burned so many times. I'd give the shirt off my back, and every time I get burned, I'm super antisocial. I have no friends. I'm sorry I gave you a hard time. Dude. From now on, I'm going to write dude like that, by the way. Dude, I don't care. I'm fine. I see something in you. My gut tells me you could have a great life. My shrink says we don't get what we want. We get what we think we deserve. I'm telling you, you deserve so much more than you know. He responds, how? And what do you see? I'm just confused how you can see that I can do better. I have multiple problems and a big hole to crawl out of, and usually I choose not to express it, or it's hard to articulate my emotions. She responds, honestly, I don't know. All you wrote was that word, but I saw it and clicked on you and saw you were just trying to get kicked off Twitter. Oh, I saw the rage and the pain and looked at your avatar and just saw so much in you, in your eyes, I guess. Don't know. Remember when Chad says it starts with seeing? He said, I saw something in you. He responds. Oh, that's it. It goes on for a little bit. Essentially, what she then does is she rallies together her Twitter followers, and together with her, she basically sends out a message, hey, Twitter followers, let's help this guy out. And together they raise money. I think he got a GoFundMe page from her Twitter followers, gets a GoFundMe page. A chiropractor catches wind of this and donates his time. And now this man is getting help for his back and some of his childhood pains. And he writes later that what she did actually saved his life. Is that interesting to you? I don't. Something about this I find so unbelievably powerful and convicting, if I'm honest. I'm not even sure Sarah Silverman's a believer. Here's the potential of the church. Here's why Sunday mornings matter. If a celebrity can use a Twitter fan base to rally support to help save someone's life, how much more can the Church of Jesus Christ, with the Holy Spirit burning in us, rooted in the knowledge of Christ, how much more can we, if we're strategic, if we're serious about it, unite together to solve the loneliness epidemic? See, there are things that the three can't do because there's not enough of you. Your family, as beautiful as it is, there are things, you've had these moments where you're trying to pull your family together because there's a medical crisis and you just don't have enough money. That the tribe, that the church, that the disciples can do. I'm telling you, every time we have a board meeting, I am moved to tears by what we're able to do together. Did you know that together we are like feeding a couple of thousand of kids every single week? I can't do that on my own, but we do it together. You know that together we mentor a couple hundred students. Could you do that on your own in a week? Do you have the time? But we do it together. We have taken care of some financial things that are astounding together. We have over 200 kids in Africa, many of which would not see adolescence had we not, in Ethiopia, had we not stepped in. 200. And we did it together. So which are we of the circles? I think we're the disciples. But it'll require us a couple things. We can't be the crowd, right? We can't turn on each other. We just can't. We can't be the crowd. And we have to be okay recognizing that there are some things on Sunday morning we can't just get. We want to connect it. Work really hard at that. We work so hard at that. We would love for you to have family, but what we can do on a Sunday morning is we can get strategic. We can think about the problems of our world and we can do something about them. We can actually do something about them. I say all this because we're about to enter into some really serious conversations. I've been working really hard on this Uncharted series that's kicking off in a couple of weeks, a week after Super Bowl. And we're going to have some serious conversations. I think the potential to see God do some amazing things through our church is right. I mean, it doesn't even take faith to believe in it. We could do some things. We could do some things. We're not going to do it without our God. We got to be rooted centered. We got to have that. You need that alone time. I don't want it. We can't fry ourselves. We can't burn ourselves out. We need family. If you don't have family, let us help you. We can't make friends for you, but let us help you. But we cannot be a crowd. We can do something about the problems. Do you believe that? I ask what's possible all the time. What is possible? I want to actually see what God could do when we need like the really big things that we actually do take faith. Like if we stepped out in ways that were truly risky, what's possible then? But that's a big conversation. Let's wrap up in prayer. Lord, King Jesus, we love you. We are inspired by you, Lord. We thank you that you gave us a model that can help us. And so, Lord, I pray that you would, Lord, you would help us to separate, to understand who are the crowds. Not that we wouldn't love them, but Lord, help us to know which people are just plugging into us and draining our battery. Lord, help us to know how to love them appropriately. Lord, I pray that you would, for anyone in this space who doesn't have family, doesn't have close friends, Lord, I pray that you would help connect really good people to each other. Help us to do that well, Jesus. Lord, I pray that every single one of us would hear your voice personally. Lord, I just don't believe we're born Christian. I think we become Christian when you invade our lives. And so, Jesus, I pray that you would invade someone's life even this morning. Lord, that you would open their eyes to your goodness and your love and your beauty. And then, Lord, I pray that you would make all of us disciples, that we would see the problems of our world and not turn a blind eye. Lord, that you would remind us that we are our brother's keeper. We have a responsibility. But you've given us your spirit, Jesus. Would we trust you? Would we trust you? We pray all this in your name. And everybody said, amen. Thank you.